Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm pleased to have as my guest for the third time, Luis Alberto Urrea. And for longtime listeners of the show, we have two interviews with Mr. Urrea currently available on the website, one from The Hummingbird's Daughter, which is currently available in paperback from Back Bay Books. And we also discussed The Devil's Highway, which is also available in paperback from Back Bay. So we're not going to be redundant and discuss the individual book, The Devil's Highway. We're going to jump into the immediacy of the problem, the political situation we find ourselves in. And first of all, Luis, thanks again for being on the show.
Thanks for having me back.
One of the things I'd like to point out to the listeners is The Hummingbird's Daughter, when you go to the bookstore, is available in paperback now, and that'll be in the fiction section. When you go in to find The Devil's Highway, you're more likely to find it in cultural studies in the nonfiction area of the bookstore. So just ask for help when you go in the bookstore in terms of finding The Devil's Highway or any of Luis's other work, because the books are not going to be together, most likely. If you're buying online, obviously, that's not a problem. But I would just like to clear that up for readers so that they know where to go in the bookstore to find the book.
Thanks, Casey. That's helpful.
Yeah.
So one of the problems of being a multi-genre writer is I think bookstores have no idea, ultimately, what to do with your stuff. And I find my work in the weirdest possible places in bookstores, you know?
Yeah.
Just not where to put it.
And I can tell you in Barnes & Noble, it's in cultural studies, so...
Yeah.
And it might be in Current Affairs and other stores.
Yeah, it's been getting Current Affairs shelving a lot, which is better. Usually I find my stuff in that little shelf that says Hispanic Studies that's way on the bottom under African-American Studies and Lesbian Studies, way down in the very corner with about five other books. And we always have the same five books.
Yeah, and then you're Urrea, so you're like the last one in the list.
Yeah, only followed by Villaseñor.
Yeah, there you go. Luis, back in October, we talked about The Devil's Highway, and at the time, we said... We were talking about how at that moment there was some legislation in New Mexico and Arizona calling this a national emergency, the border situation. And then the Iraq War came along and took away the headlines, and it kind of disappeared for a while. And now suddenly, a couple weeks ago, 500,000 people are in the streets of Los Angeles about the undocumented workers here in the United States. And what do you think caused this? There's obviously the Senate and the House bill. What is it in particular about these bills you think that is causing the uproar?
You know, it's been a bafflement to me on some level, you know, because this is not an issue that's new to anybody. And this kind of movement toward trying to legislate the border has been approached a few times in the past. It's just one of those moments, I think, that are like, you know, the Tipping Point book, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the Tipping Point, he says that information becomes viral at a certain point and is spread like an epidemic. Somehow, the different sides of the immigration problem seem to have all hit Tipping Point at once. And I don't quite understand the sort of wildfire that broke out. It became this instant kind of political fad. You know, part of me feels like it's some kind of smokescreen on one side, you know, to draw attention to, quote, illegal immigration all of a sudden and perhaps relieve focus on something else. I'm not sure. That's my paranoid side. I'll tell you, certainly here in Chicago, you know, we had the first of the big rallies here, and it wasn't really covered. But when I saw what was happening here, I thought, oh, man, this is going to be something huge, and it's going to be national. I'm sure of it. They were expecting 5,000, 25,000. They got easily 100,000, if not more, people. And the reporting of it, I thought, was fascinating because... you know, talk radio here in town has gone very conservative, even though Chicago is sort of a traditionally Democratic city. The talk radio is very conservative here. And they were saying, well, several thousand illegal aliens were marching demanding rights. Which I thought was hilarious because, you know, first of all, that's not what was going on. And the other thing, which you hear over and over again, was they were flying the Mexican flag. They were holding up the Mexican flag. And they have no right to come to this country uninvited and hold up the flag of another country. And what was ironic is that my school where I teach, University of Illinois, was right on the edge of this area where the rally was. So to try to get out of work that day and go home was almost impossible because the streets were full of hundreds, literally, of marchers coming home. And every group that I saw was carrying American flags. There were Mexican flags, don't get me wrong, but people were carrying American flags too. And I thought, what an interesting bit of reporting. A few illegals, and they were all doing Mexican, anti-American propaganda. And I thought, you know, it was really kind of a very different thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, I think this is what happens on the border anyway. There's a different story going on than I think the story that we hear. You know, it's a different story we're told. Both sides. I want to say both sides. I think Mexico gets a really warped view of this border issue, just like the United States does.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things, I share your paranoia of there seems to be this cover your ass thing going on, and part of it has to be because the Latino vote is becoming very important in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
And President Bush, I believe it was around 40 or 45% of Latinos voted for President Bush, didn't they, Luis, in 2004?
Yeah, it was very high.
Yeah, so I mean, you're looking at a growing segment of the population, which is very important politically, and so I think that's definitely part of it. And then what I found fascinating 2 days ago was the Catholic Church is now in Los Angeles is now getting involved in kind of weighing in on the undocumented worker problem,
right.
Which I find a little kind of the timing of that a little interesting too, in light of the problems the Catholic Church is facing. That it's kind of like, okay, we can look at the illegal immigration situation and deflect the news about the problems with the pedophile priests.
Right.
I don't like to think that way.
Well, I will tell you, just between us and, of course, everybody listening, but it seems to me that this population that we're talking about, this undocumented population, or if you want to call them illegals or whatever you want to call them, are a perfect population for almost anyone who wants to exploit them for almost any reason. You know, they are the definition of a captive audience in a certain sense. And so they fit any mold. If you want to be, you know, if you want to be a dewy-eyed liberal, they fit. If you want to be a racist xenophobe, they fit. If you want to use them to put up a little, you know, barrier between the chicanery you're pulling in the real world, they fit. Because in some ways they are more an illusion than anything else. Do you know what I mean? They are these invisible people who, by the nature of what's happening to them, have to remain invisible. And one thing that's been so startling, I think, is the realization that they are here, and there are a lot of them, and there are people who are sympathetic to them. One of the shocks, I think, to America is finding out that a lot of people are quite sympathetic to these folks. If you go to hang out with the Border Patrol, for example, the people you would guess would be the least sympathetic to these guys, you'll find that many of the agents are quite sympathetic to them and very understanding of their situation. And I've had agents... Surprising to me, because I felt that I was critical of everybody at Devil's Highway, for example, but a lot of the Border Patrol agents have been in touch with me over the last couple of years, happy that somebody just told their story, which I thought was good. One of them said to me, you know, I don't care if you agree with me or don't, or approve of me or disapprove of me and what I do, but just tell it honestly. And so I felt really good. And, you know, we've talked before about nonfiction, that you could get the story across and people felt that you represented them straight. But they get in touch with me a lot, and they talk about this often. You know, I would go to any country on earth to feed my wife and children.
Yes.
No question.
Yes.
You know, they say that over and over to me. So they're very sympathetic, and I think they understand the issue. And one of the things that breaks my heart is that I feel that, you know, even though it's easy to play a race card, even though it's easy to play panic invasion card, even though it's all this stuff, and we could get into all the layers of propaganda and paranoia that are laid on these people, you know, there is also a deep affection between our populations. And, you know, there are places where we actually enjoy each other. And we forget. You're led to believe that it's all horror and exploitation and violence and ugliness, and it's not necessarily the case.
No, I agree completely. And one of the things that I've been having a lot of conversations with people lately about this, and The Devil's Highway, the reason I'm recommending it so strongly that people read is that there's a physical part of coming across the border which cannot be ignored when we discuss this as a national issue, because as you and I discussed before, once a person comes from Mexico into the United States, they've literally taken their lives into their hands.
Right.
And there's a fear about crossing back over the border. And in The Devil's Highway, you paint the picture of the physical demands of walking through the desert, and that's something that cannot be denied when you're looking at the situation that we're looking at.
Yeah, it's astonishing what people go through to get here. Absolutely astonishing. And, you know, there are a couple of things that you can say about this. One of them is that I know that people feel the urge to panic and be suspicious and unwelcoming. But, you know, if people understood how much someone has suffered to get here, you know, I think they would feel at least a bit of admiration for the struggle. But, you know, it's like the social Darwinist's ultimate test. It's an entrance exam that few of us could pass. And, you know, it's kind of funny. Some of those Border Patrol agents used to say to me, you know, it's really weird. Anglos get out here in this desert and they're dead in literally a couple hours. How do these Mexicans survive days and weeks doing it? And I thought, there's something really weird about that. You know, the kind of drive and perseverance in the face of panic and pain and suffering and certainly deadly conditions to make somebody come across. But it should speak to some of the sure desperation and panic, but also to the strength and the drive and the vision of somebody who would do that to come here to work. Now, one of the things about the fear of the return trip is, to me, one of the big ironies about this, in that crossing was very strongly and traditionally a migratory pattern, just like migratory birds, north and south. It would ebb and flow. And we have stepped up, you know, enforcement policies, interdiction policies, stepped up urban corridor clampdowns, as you well know, in like San Diego, you know, Nogales, Tucson area, El Paso, on to Laredo and Brownsville. They're much more controlled. So people flow around it into the wilderness. And because the situation became more and more kind of wild west out in the wilderness, this really gave rise to a whole lot of the new criminal element that's controlling much, if not most, of the border crossing coming in from Mexico. And that is strongly tied up, and more so all the time, with the narco-smuggling world. So there is a kind of a pitched war building, armed conflict building on the border between our side and their side. Not Mexico and the United States, but cops and soldiers and criminals and gangbangers. Now, what's ironic about this beefing up of the border is that people get here, but it is such a hassle to go home and come back, go home and come back. And it's so expensive to go home and come back now that people stay. So one of the weird benefits of beefing up the border is that it has kept undocumented people in the United States. It doesn't seem to be keeping people out.
Right.
Because a lot of people are coming across every year. But once they get here, it's much easier to get five guys into a motel room, as you will find right here in Naperville, Illinois, the whitest town in the world, doing jobs and Western Unioning the money home, which is what, of course, is now the new paradigm. People come here, establish themselves, they send remittance money electronically back home. The amount of money going home is overwhelming. It's huge. It's, you know, last year it was reported as $17 billion a year in the New York Times, $45 billion going back to the Caribbean and Central America in general, but $17 billion specifically to Mexico.
And then the number...
You know,
yeah, there was
I joked, I think, in Devil's Highway that we have a very generous foreign policy. We just filter it through Burger King.
There you go. There's I read a statistic the other day, too, of the amount of money paid into the Social Security system.
Yeah.
I think it was $430 million last year.
No, check this out.
Is it?
The Center for Immigration Studies put out the figures, and Harper's ran it in the Harper's Index, so it was easy to miss. I just kind of stumbled across it because I had to give a speech in Colorado about immigration. It's as of last year, the figure was $6.4 billion a year is going into Social Security. When I gave my speech in Colorado, a councilwoman from Denver came and took me aside, and she said, "We've been investigating this, and we believe the figure is now up to $7 billion a year, which is 10% of Social Security surplus. If that $7 billion a year were pulled out, Social Security would collapse." And it was this moment of weird revelation to me, because when I was working on Devil's Highway, one of the consuls, one of the Mexican consuls, I won't say which because I don't want to put him in jeopardy, but he told me in his office, "Do you know why the United States is inviting us into the country to do this work without documents?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Because we are supporting Social Security. They give us the jobs so that we keep the old white people in food. And if we leave, they starve." And I thought at the time, that's just crazy. You know, that's Art Bell stuff. That's some kind of propaganda mystery stuff. And I didn't put it in my book. And it turned out to be borne out later by the facts that he was telling me the truth, that they understood in the Mexican government that there was a kind of a carte blanche, unwritten invitation to keep those people coming here, partially because of not only Social Security, but the tax base that they could be hit for, money that they will never get back. This is money just, you know, we could say a voluntary gift, a tithes and offerings.
Sure, sure.
Unrepresented investment in tax and Social Security. So $6.4 billion a year.
Yeah, that's a huge number, and
a lot of money.
Yeah, and like you say, the odds of ever getting that back are, even some of the reforms they're looking at, you're looking at 11 years until someone would be offered citizenship. So
yeah,
they're never going to get any of that money back.
No way.
Luis, what about joining the military? If you join the military, you're granted immediate citizenship. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true.
I think I read where they've changed it so where if you enlist in the services, you are offered citizenship.
Yeah.
And we won't even go there.
Well, you know, it kind of smacks of things like, you know, the Roman Empire or something.
Yeah.
You know, we're Shanghaiing these guys. I don't know. It's just this really odd conscript kind of situation. And this question that, you know, you're welcome to go die for us. You know, and I understand the feeling of invasion and panic, of course. And
sure.
Part of it, again, is how things are presented to us, right? The illegals. You keep hearing the illegal immigration. They've broken the law to get here. And that sounds really bad. And And now they're saying, let's criminalize it. Well, how can you criminalize it if it's illegal? I don't think Americans are listening to the facts. Being illegal is a very specific breaking of the law. It's civil law. It's not criminal law. It's, you know, civil law is a law about torts, contracts, and agreements. Civil law is a speeding ticket. So when people come here, they break a civil law. They have essentially broken a law which is akin to driving 75 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when I give talks and I am going to get people who are really angry at me because they figure I'm cutting fences down to let illegals in just because I'm trying to, you know, explain the things to people as I see them, I ask the audience, did anybody speed coming here today? Did anybody go 5 miles over the speed limit? Because if you did, you are not a citizen of my country, and I would like you to leave
mm-hmm.
because you're un-American.
Mm-hmm.
You've broken the law. So criminalizing being here makes an insane situation, if you think about it. If you can imagine 11 million, and believe me, I think that's a conservative number, 11 million felons all of a sudden, what in the hell are we supposed to do with them?
Right, as if the jails had room.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, now.
Yeah, oh, yeah, we have all this great room in every prison. Are we going to put them in prison? I don't think so.
Right.
You know, somebody had done a study, and I cannot remember the amount of money involved, but it was in the billions of dollars, what it would cost to round everyone up and get them out of the country. We can't afford that.
And I think one of the things, Luis, that this is also an example of the polarization of the United States. One of the things that we should be talking about is how can we realistically deal with this? Because I think everyone agrees that if someone, no matter what country they come from, if they're performing illegal activities, if they're involved in gangs, if they're distributing drugs, they should be in jail.
I agree. Absolutely. But again, you know, I think we have to very calmly and sanely look at what the real story is and who the real people are. We see some of the very visible stuff. You hear right now everybody worrying about MS-13. Very bad gang, no question.
Right.
Evil gang, no question. Al-Qaeda sympathizers? Maybe. They're sympathizers of money. MS-13 wants money. It is true that, you know, they will smuggle people into the country if they pay them enough. They don't care. Okay, you see that a lot. But I don't know if you caught about 2 weeks ago in the New York Times, there was an op-ed piece that just blew me away. It was a piece about the dropping serious felony rate in the United States and how nobody can explain why serious crime and murder and so forth is on the downtrend. And it has been for the last 10 years. And this guy proposed an insane idea, which was, you know, if you chart it along with the rise in, quote, illegal immigration, it's kind of eerie that the rise or the apparent rise in illegal immigration has coincided directly with the drop in the serious crime rates. And he was proposing, is it possible that this population is actually lessening crime? And he went into statistics about how the Latino population is in fact more law-abiding than many other populations in this country. So, you know, you start thinking about some eerie things, which are the benefits these folks bring. You hear about the bad things, but the benefits they're bringing ultimately in the big picture may start to surprise us. And, you know, I hear from Mexican politicians who surreptitiously contact me because of my books. And, you know, they've sent me the border reform plans that they've been working on. And guess what? They're almost word for word the same as the McCain and Kennedy stuff.
Interesting.
I mean, they want the same kind of stuff. And, you know, they think that people who have been here paying taxes and learning English should get a shot to stay. Now, I understand it's self-serving on Mexico's part because they can't deal with their own poor, and they don't want them to come home. Mexico's big panic is that all these folks will get to retirement age and all come home.
Yeah.
And Mexico will explode.
Yeah, Luis, let's talk for a moment. Let's shift gears for a moment. Yep. What is this doing to Mexico?
Wow.
That's a huge question, but it's a topic that doesn't get discussed a lot.
No, and just in little ways, it's having a bizarre effect. There are places in Mexico right now that have no men. It's the weirdest thing. If you can read stories about towns where the women actually get men from other cities to come just so they can meet men.
Wow.
There are no men left. This is going to be a really strange thing, I think, politically, in that in the absence of the male dominant presence, I think you're going to see women / feminists start to step up and take more and more control. That feminization of Mexico is going to be a very powerful and, I think, brilliant change nobody has foreseen. One of the damages to Mexico is that the situation has sent out, honestly, the hardest working, the strongest generation, the young generation, the best and the brightest, and even the worst, but still, you know, strong. So Mexico has gutted itself in a lot of ways, culturally, physically, and so forth. Now, the remittance money is an amazing thing going back into Mexico, no question. $17 billion a year, which is the people who have remained at home are using that money to do infrastructure. Not all of it. I mean, you know, clearly people are getting nice houses and pickup trucks too. But there are communities in Mexico that are starting to see that that money that the Mexican government can't or won't spend to help them is coming in from Chicago, L.A., New York, Des Moines, wherever. And they're starting to invest it in schools and sidewalks, stuff like that. So, you know, there's this weird thing in which Mexico has taken a quick solution, which is send out your underclass, which you can't support, get rid of them. Take the money back from the United States. It's a quick, you know, it's like a crack addict solution. I think ultimately it's dangerous for Mexico as a sovereign entity. Again, because, you know, you've given away a whole generation to the next door neighbors to get yourself out of trouble. You're kind of living on credit, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. You're getting all this money, which is intoxicating, but you're also getting the influence of the United States back.
Now, Luis, the Mexicans living in the United States, are they allowed to vote in Mexico?
They are now. They're not willing to do it in great numbers yet. But, you know, those same guys that have been writing to me who are sort of, I guess you'd call them closet liberals in the Mexican government, who, you know, they were really against allowing the extranjeros, you know, the ciudadanos en el extranjero, as they call them, the citizens in strange lands to vote, because they knew that that would be a soft revolution, because people who are living here and, you know, whatever civil liberties we have left, which are questionable to me, but they're still better than civil liberties elsewhere, you know, are going to start enforcing, if they do come out and vote, a kind of a border perestroika. They're going to start voting back home for people who are pro-democracy. There's no question of that in my mind, that, you know, the influence of the money, a stream of $17 billion, if directed intelligently, could change the world. A stream of millions of voters aiming intelligently could change the world. So those two things are going to have a big effect in Mexico, aside from other little things. You know, the maquiladora phenomenon, the NAFTA thing, didn't really work out. NAFTA went to Mexico and then booked out of there for China and India. And those factories are, you know, in since Devil's Highway was done being researched and came out and I toured, 500 factories closed.
Wow.
You know, that's a bad scene.
Yeah.
But the weird thing is, you know, they're going cheap. And now they're little Mexican straight-up industries that are moving into some pretty fancy stuff that would have never had a shot at those before. So there are all these strange, I think, hopeful things, but I think Mexico has hurt itself. I don't know how bad the damage is, but I think it's crippled itself.
Yeah. Luis, is there a leader in the United States for the undocumented workers? Is there...
Is there a Martin Luther King kind of guy, you mean?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Not yet. I think if Cesar Chavez had been alive, he might have taken a mantle of some kind of humane leadership for it. I don't see anybody, taking their cause yet. But I'm sure there will be. I mean, you know, there are guys trying, like Cienfuegos with the La Raza movement in L.A. and various people. But I'm real weary, again, of exploitation. This is the population that is most exploited by all sides. And so do-gooders can seem kind of exploitive to me, too. So I just don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not seeing anyone that I would say, wow, that person's really, you know, really the one.
Yeah, okay. Well, Luis, one of the things, I'd like to tell the listeners that Luis and I are going to do an interview, a companion interview with this, which will be repetitive in nature in Spanish, which will be available on the website. One of the things I'd like to talk about before we wrap up this part is, what effect is this having on other minorities in the United States? I mean, you look at General Motors in Detroit offering to buy out all of their hourly workers.
Yeah.
And you're looking at the unemployment rate among young African Americans in this country being astronomical. How do you see this whole thing? I think it's interrelated to a certain extent, and that's where part of the exploitation and this polarization of either the extreme liberal side or the extreme conservative side comes in.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of issues at stake here, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's one of the heartbreaks to me to see, you know, this population being used to further polarize and kind of undermine the African-American community, certainly. But, I mean, just witness what's going on in New Orleans, right?
Mm-hmm.
New Orleans has become an incredible magnet for very hardworking, very good, decent people who happen to be Hispanic, who happen to be willing to work for pennies on the dollar. And the tragedy is just that you have a population that's desperate and eager and willing to take crap conditions to do these jobs. And, you know, the big myth, oh, yeah, they do the job that Americans won't do, or Vicente Fox's, you know, ill-conceived announcement that they do the jobs even blacks won't do, which is a pretty, you know, racist comment. And but the point is that, you know, people, you know, you can't go do a job for money that you'd get even less than minimum wage. And one of the things with this population is that they're willing to work for less than minimum wage, and they tend to depress minimum wage. There's a great, in this last Sunday's Times, in fact, there's a really interesting bunch of charts and grids you can look up that have, you know, how much they affect minimum wage. And the Hispanic community is one of the largest ones. So, you know, as long as an American worker cannot get a decent salary or cannot get health care benefits, you know, there's someone willing to do without those things to keep working. And what drives me crazy is some of the people who rail the most against this population are the people who are actually profiting, and I mean that straight up, profiting big money profits off their being here. And, you know, they're largely people who I think were assaultive to the black population once and continue to be. They've just learned a better language to do it in.
Mm-hmm.
So it breaks my heart, and if you know, if we could be united, it would be a very powerful thing. But the paradigm that you see play out in the barrios and the ghettos, you know, is a very successful one for those who don't want those folks getting ahead. They fight and kill just for a street corner.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we, you know, somebody once said the fighting is so savage because there's so little at stake.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
As your focus is kept down on this daily grind, and you're stealing from me because everybody's stealing from me, and you're coming from You know, it's this endless population of propaganda meisters that keep throwing these phrases. I think the war among people who are needy continues.
Yeah, we're even seeing it in West Virginia in the coal mines now. With the conditions down there, there are people of various minorities, a lot of Somalians, willing to work in the coal mines now, and that's becoming a problem now. We have a very large Somali population in Columbus, Ohio, where I live.
Yeah.
So here's another, here's another large group of people that we're trying to assimilate into the culture. And one of the interesting things is, and we'll wrap up this section with this, is part of the reforms is an insistence that people learn how to speak English.
Right.
And that's going to place a tremendous strain on an educational system which is already bursting at the seams if we require all of the different minorities to learn how to speak English. It's much more complicated when you do the math on it than it appears on first blush, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I think all of the soundbite solutions that you hear are extremely simplified because they play easily. And, you know, people always complain about the Democratic Party that they, you know, they have policy wonks and they don't have charismatic people. Well, charismatic people are charismatic because they have simple solutions. And the reality is that we have a very complex and shifting worldwide paradigm. It's not just in the United States. I mean, witness the riots in France. You know, witness any country you want to see that's having this shift. Thomas Friedman always talks about the world being flat now, and I didn't agree with him at first, but I'm seeing what he means, that this, you know, this is the reality now, and no amount of talk and chatter and posturing is going to reverse it. We are never going to go back to 1959. It's not going to happen. To me, this whole situation is like global warming. I don't care who's causing it. I don't care if, you know, I care that it's here and we better plan for it and do something about it. There's nothing I can do pointing fingers or complaining or railing or any of that. I need to find a way to make my world work, you
right.
know. And yeah, speaking English, it sounds fair. I'm for it. I think as a person, you know, who was born in Tijuana, my dad was a Mexican national, legal, by the way. He was here on a green card. You know, my dad learned English by memorizing 5 pages of the dictionary a week, and he would quiz himself with his friends. They'd have English competitions. Those kind of things are important, and I think, you know, we have to take responsibility as world citizens, those of us who are here legally, supposedly, or illegally, to watch, you know, after ourselves. And I think some of us feel like we're victims and we've thrown up our hands and somebody's got to come do it for us.
Yeah.
The very fact that people made it here means that they can take responsibility for being able to survive here. And, you know, I just want to say that people are learning English as best they can. It isn't always up to standards, but as one of the politicians in Mexico, in fact, wrote to me today, they all say in Mexico that, you know, Vicente Fox and George Bush have one thing in common. They are unintelligible in English. So, you know, it ain't just the undocumented that
right,
need to learn.
Right. And here at the Columbus Literacy Council here in Columbus just built a beautiful new building. And it was really exciting for me. I went down and toured the facility, and it was filled with Somalians and Latinos, adults learning how to speak English.
Yeah.
Because teaching the kids how to speak English is one thing, but we also have an adult population which we need to educate.
Absolutely. And you know, I think here's one of the issues. You know, if you feel secure, if you feel accepted in any way as a human being and appreciated as a human being, you strive. If you feel afraid, dirty, unwelcome, filthy, disease-ridden, which is the thing you're starting to hear now, you don't feel like you can strive, and you stay in the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
You become what Oscar Acosta used to call the cockroach people. You hide in the cracks and the shadows. So, you know, it's part of the self-fulfilling prophecy of what's happening with immigration that people don't achieve because they're not asked to achieve. They are asked to scrub toilets and cut meat and stay in that level. And, you know, there's a very important level because they're servicing stuff. But, you know, they just need the slightest bit of acknowledgement. I'm not saying blanket amnesty because
sure.
I don't think that's probably a great idea either. But, you know, some sort of sane policy because it's a population that cannot survive at home, had to come here to survive. The entire issue, no matter what the propaganda tells you, is about work, period. People talk about welfare benefits. People talk about getting free health care or, you know, getting school stuff. It's about jobs. If the jobs stopped, everybody stops coming. No question. It's about the bosses. And I think if you want to look at a paradigm and ask yourself if it's worked or not, look at the war on drugs. If you feel that the war on drugs has worked really well, then all the immigration hardline stuff is going to be for you. But if you suspect that the war on drugs, and I have never used drugs, so I'm not speaking as a druggie, I'm just speaking as an observer. If you suspect the war on drugs has not worked out particularly well, then you have to think about reforms. Because it's the same kind of thing. We can bust a street corner dime bag seller 15 times a day, but unless we bust the person up in the penthouse,
yeah,
the person living in the mansion in the Hamptons, you know, it's not going to change.
Yeah. Well, Luis, I'll tell you what, this has been great. I'm so glad we had a chance to do this to update the Devil's Highway.
Yeah, man.
And were you a fan of Sam Kinison by any choice?
I like Sam Kinison, yeah.
You know, I was thinking, last night I was driving home, and I started laughing because I knew we were going to be talking today, and I was thinking if Sam Kinison were alive, what he would say about the current situation, I wish he could come down from wherever he is and just do like a one-hour monologue on this thing.
On immigration.
Yeah, you know, like go through the Bible and find out where it says you have to show documentation to receive help from a church.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we're going to make those church workers felons, by the way. That's great.
Yeah, I could just see what Sam Kinison would do with some of the material that he would have available to him right now. And he would do it. He would have no qualms about doing it.
Well, you know, the awful thing about it is it's funny. If you have a morbid and dark sense of humor, it's so perverted and dark that it is quite funny.
Yeah, it's sad but and tragic.
It is
but
sad.
But great. Well, Luis, again, this is I'm thrilled that we've had a chance to talk about the Devil's Highway. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this is that in the book business, what happens is you have something that an event that occurs like what happened out in Los Angeles,
right?
And the market's going to get flooded in the next 6 months with poorly written books that are thrown together to take advantage of the situation. And you have a book out there, The Devil's Highway, which presents an intelligent, accurate, balanced approach that people should read about this situation. And that's why I wanted to have you back on, is because
well,
you and I both know that in 6 months there's going to be a table in the bookstores on illegal immigration, and it's going to be polarized. There's going to be very little balanced reporting, but they'll be there, you know, in stacks.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. You know, I oddly enough, I've seen this already affected. You know, they've gone back for further printings of Devil's Highway already, so you know I can see it starting to move again.
Good. And so to wrap up, Hummingbird's
right.
Daughter available in trade paper now.
Yeah.
Devil's Highway available in trade paper. And if you're interested, Luis and I will be doing an interview in Spanish. So Luis, thanks for appearing on the show.